Welcome back to Card Knock Life. I'm Corey, here's Daryl. And we are on the other side of a turkey day. Thanks for being with us as we took another week off to enjoy the holidays.
Many chickens were had on my side. We did not have turkey.
Oh, you did chickens, huh?
Chickens. Chickens are much easier. They only took like an hour and a half to cook. Great.
Yeah, man, that is my favorite holiday, I swear. There's nothing like eating a bunch of food and falling asleep in a chair watching football.
You're pretty close to right. Like, honestly, you get much better than just eat. Being the most American you can be by being completely gluttonous.
Yeah.
And then being the most American you can be by being completely lazy. Like,
Yeah. I went with a coworker to lunch on Tuesday before break. And we went out to a Chinese restaurant. He was telling me a story of an older lady that was standing in front of him asking the clerk at the Chinese restaurant or whoever was cashing her out how to say Happy Thanksgiving in Chinese. And the woman said, "We don't have that word because we don't celebrate Thanksgiving in China." And she could not believe it. Mind you, this is like small town Wisconsin. So I work kind of up in the suburb sort of rural area.
Yeah, just off Milwaukee.
She was just shocked, man. She couldn't handle it.
A brand new world revealed to her that some countries don't celebrate Thanksgiving.
It just reminds you of, how American the damn holiday is. It's, you know, the day we sat down to eat, and then the Pilgrims must have played football or something, because that's a big part of this holiday now, too.
The Pilgrims just stole people's land, which is basically all football is about. Stealing your opponent's land while carrying a round pig.
Yes, violent competition, which translates to football in 2017 standards.
Correct.
Anyways, let's get on with the Magic talk. Stuff has happened since we last spoke. Mostly, let's talk about Iconic Masters. The release of Iconic Masters happened recently. And I have heard almost nothing about events going on in my area related to Iconic Masters. There's very, very little hype for this based on the long time period between the reveal of the set and the actual release of the set.
So there's a lot of hype for me just on watching the prices dip. And, you know, I took some hits financially for my collection on that. You know, I had a couple Fluster Storms and went from $100 to $25 or $50, whatever, you know, the original printing went to. But, like, you can look at some of the cards, and you can see that getting copies of them from Iconic Masters is going to be muy bien for your wallet compared to how much they used to be, which is a huge deal to me. I don't, you know, particularly care that I took, you know, the $100, $200 loss in Cryptic Commands, Fluster Storms, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to be able to buy all the other cards I want from the set at a cheaper price.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think, Daryl, like, the set... I certainly don't expect this set to have been played as much as Wizards had originally anticipated with this thing because of all the hype that they put out to it in the HasCon. And now that it's coming out, we have all this hype for Unstable. You know, they're basically spoiling all of Unstable in the midst of this release, which seems quite backwards. I mean, this is supposed to be a huge release for them. But maybe the point is, like, just merely that this set exists is enough to affect the prices. Like, these cards just need to be reprinted, and we just need to know that they're being reprinted. Yeah. But I don't know that it's going to get opened as much as any of the other Master sets. You know,
I mean,
I don't know if the supply is really increasing.
I think the supply is about on par with the rest of the Master sets, and I think it'll just get opened. Like, people want to chase after the cards in the set.
Sure.
So, I mean, we can take a look at a couple of, you know, modern mainstays, and you can see what the price of them was before and after Iconic Masters.
Yeah, even just Eternal mainstays.
Yeah, I'm going to start with Grove of the Burn Willows.
All right.
So, Grove of the Burn Willows, Future Sight, Hour of Devastation, and then Ixalan. So I'm going to guess that the Iconic Masters preview stuff happened before Hour of Devastation. So... right at our Gestation release, $46 for Grove of the Burn Willows in paper, $20 online. Iconic Masters, you can get a Grove of the Burn Willows with the From the Ball art with the other art, $12.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, 66% off of, or what is it? More than that. It's a quarter of the price it was 3 months ago, 4 months ago.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's a very good thing for Modern.
Yeah,
these cards are, you know, they're big pieces of the decks that they exist in, and they're a very limited print. Now, the other side of this is, too, that the original printings of these cards are in Future Sight, where they have that really unique border. So from a collector's perspective, like, if you've got those original art cards, they're going to hold some value over these Modern Masters reprints of them because of that unusual border. Just like Tarmogoyf, Future Sight Tarmogoyf has a different price tag than any other reprinting.
Absolutely. I agree. Another big one that took a dip, Ancestral Visions.
Yeah.
That card, I'm pretty sure, was around $40, the original printing. Let me check here and pull it up. It was $54 original printing before our devastation back in the middle of July.
Yeah.
You can get one, I think, for $19 now.
Yeah, you can get it for about $25. $25.
So I see TCG player for the new Ancestral Visions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying, you know, what's the price on the new one? Because that's probably gonna be the cheapest one you can get. $15.
Okay, that's a market price.
Yeah, market price.
Yeah.
And, you know, online Ancestral Visions went from $23 to $6. You know,
real rough.
I took a hit on that one. I owned more Ancestral Visions, and the price bottomed out real hard.
It was destined to happen at some point anyway. That card isn't seeing nearly as much play as we had all hoped for when it first was unbanned.
Yeah, and it was slowly going down, and it kind of, I think around Iconic Masters, it took a hit from $16 to $7, sure. And that's really what plummeted, and then the rest of Iconic Masters bottomed it out from $10 to $6.
Here's another one where many players probably prefer the original art on this one. I don't know that I'm personally a big fan of the new art on Visions, and it's quite different than the original printing of this one. There was also a pre-constructed product. I can't remember which one. Maybe a Versus deck.
Visions. Jace looks stronger.
So both of those had the original art. Thoughtseize, on the other hand, is a card that now got reprinted with the old art, and I know there was some controversy on that. Is collectors were saying, let me just have this one thing. You know, like, let me keep that old art that's so sought after. And if you're going to reprint the card for availability purposes, then put the Lorwyn, or the Ravnica art on, the Return to Ravnica art.
Yeah.
But they give us the old art, which I'm... Personally, I am in favor of that, but I can see the argument that collectors and players that have been playing for a long time and have access to those original Lorwyn arts would feel a little slighted.
I mean, we're just talking about a picture, dude. Like,
we are, but the value is going to be different due to that picture. You know, there's a perceived value based on the nostalgia, you know?
Sure. But so let's look at the original Lorwyn copies.
Sure.
You know, in paper, they were at 50. Probably right before the Iconic Masters, they dropped to 43, and they're still hanging at 37. You know, that's almost three times the price, or twice the price. 39 would be three times the price for the market price on Thoughtseize with the old art in Iconic Masters.
Yeah, so that's still surprising to me.
They're still hanging at three times the price.
Yeah,
like, it's not like you got totally destroyed. Like, And actually, the Theros ones are holding... whoops, that's foil Theros. Whoops. the Theros ones are holding at 16. So just above the original art. So people prefer the original printing, but based on current market price, the IMA one is actually a bit cheaper on TCG Player.
Okay. Maybe in the long run, those will look a little more similar, but...
Yeah, I think so. But I think they'll...
Yeah.
So 16-15 versus 16-12 on MTG Goldfish. So they're basically equivalent right now.
Sure.
But you can get market price on TCG Player $13. So
yeah, I mean, I don't know that we necessarily need to go through all of the comparisons of prices, because it's, you know, there are plenty of sources for that at this point.
Yeah.
We're kind of beyond that. But the point is that this has affected prices. It has increased availability for Modern players, and cards are more accessible as a result of it.
And I think that's great. I own a bunch of these cards, and I've taken a bunch of value hits, but you know what? Fine. People can play. Let the people play. There's really only one disappointment I got from Iconic Masters.
What's that?
I haven't opened a Mana Drain yet.
No.
I need one for EDH, and I haven't opened one. So, yeah. But, like, I mean, yeah, that's a card that you want to point at price drops. Yeah. You know, the original Mana Drain still holding its price because it's the old art and it's from Legends and it's, you know, all this, you know, old nostalgia. $175. You can get Mana Drains on TCG Player for $70. You know, that's a huge difference. So things like that happening are good for the game.
Yeah, I mean, the first one is like four different card borders removed from the latest printing of it. And it's got new art. So there's quite a bit of difference between the two cards. If the cards are expensive because they're old and collectible, then the original Mana Drain is a prime example of, you know, a card that's going to hold its value despite an availability-based reprint. So there's that. All right, anyways, let's go on and talk about the Rivals of Ixalan spoilers. Because in the midst of all this, not only are we having unstable spoilers, but there are Rivals of Ixalan spoilers sneaking out.
I like them. I'm a huge fan of these.
I'm a huge fan, too. Amongst them, we have five cards spoiled so far. Silvergill Adept, a reprint from Lorwyn.
That needed to be reprinted.
Is this going to make Merfolk a thing? Is this single-handedly going to make Merfolk a thing in Standard?
I haven't seen a good Lord.
Yeah.
If there's a good Lord in Unstable... Or Unstable, Jesus. In Rivals of Ixalan, if there's a good Lord, it'll be playable. But just for Modern, it needed a reprint.
Yeah, absolutely. That card was unnecessarily expensive. Yeah. As are many of the fish pieces. I mean, we got like Curse Catchers that were like $7 at one point.
Oh, they were higher than that at one point.
Really?
I think they peaked at like 10 or 11, yeah.
Whew. So Silvergill Adept is a big boon to the Merfolk deck. It needed some more 2-drops to round out the curve. We're going to need some more 1-drops probably, or some more playable 1-costed cards for that tempo thing to happen. But Lord, I think, is a big factor. I didn't even consider that.
Yeah. Like, Merfolk is only really a playable deck because in Modern, because you have 12 lords.
Sure. And but so, it's a different environment.
Yeah. You
know, we do have the 4-mana Lord.
I mean, and that might be enough. I think I didn't know we had a 4-mana Lord. See how much I pay attention to Standard. but a 4-mana Lord, you might be able to curve out 1, 2, 3. And if your opponent doesn't have a Pyroclasm effect, your 4-mana Lord might be good enough. Right. But like a cheap, efficient Lord would totally benefit the Merfolk deck.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely would agree with that. All right. So we've got that one. We've also got Galta Primal Hunger, which looks to be maybe a buy box promo or store championship promo is what it says.
Big dumb trampoline. That's all I have to say about it. Yeah, no 10 green for a 12 mana or for a 12/12 legendary creature, Elder Dinosaur. It costs X less to cast, or X is the total power of creatures you control, and it has trample. Big dumb trampoline. Unnecessary, I don't think. Like, so here's my problem with this.
Yeah.
The worlds where you're playing this guy for 2, 3, 4 mana, you're already. But if you can give this guy like haste and play him for like 6 mana, I mean, like, what haste enabler do you have?
Well, you've got the Regisaur Alpha.
Regisaur Alpha does give. So you could curve Regisaur Alpha into this. Because Regisaur Alpha is a 5/3, right? And it gives you a 3/3?
Yeah. No, not a 5/3. What is it? A 4/4 or something. It's not that good.
Let me look it up. Google this. What is this called?
Yeah, it's a 4/4. 5 for a 4/4. Other dinosaurs you control have haste. You get a 3/3. Right. So I mean, you get 7 power dudes.
Yeah, you still curve Regisaur Alpha into this guy. That's about the best line you're gonna get out of this dude.
Right, I think that's exactly his function.
Literally killing your opponent on turn 6. So like, you could do nothing for the first 4 turns and then kill your opponent on turn 6. But
That's gotta be exactly the plan for this guy. You know, I mean, there are other advantages to playing him in that it's just so huge and just can beat him down. But it has so many drawbacks in that. It's so easy to answer. They've got a turn to, you know, respond to it. And it's hard to block.
So I'm going to be honest. On 6 mana, I'm going to give you 2 options. Some which one you'd like.
Okay.
This guy. Or Carnage Tyrant.
Yeah, I think I want Carnage Tyrant.
Yep, me too.
Especially if you're talking about the curve. Registrar Alpha needs to curve into this guy. We're talking turn four and then turn five with one of the mana dorks that for the dinosaurs. Same is true for Carnage Tyrant, turn four and turn five. So
yeah. I would rather Carnage Tyrant, because Carnage Tyrant doesn't really die.
Yeah. You know where this guy actually fits, though? This is, like, more often than not, I see cards like this, and also there's a card called a Tachan Worm that just get used because it's got a huge mana cost. And this is a mono-green huge mana cost. I don't think we've got any 12-mana mono-green cards, and I may be wrong about that. But when it comes to things like Nourishing Shoal, for example, a Tachan Worm functions just fine for Nourishing Shoal, but this is, like, four more copies of cards that can be Nourishing Shoal if needed.
But why not just play World Fine Worm?
How much does that cost? I thought it was 7.
11.
11? Okay. Yeah, so it's probably irrelevant. But I'm just saying that the mana cost in itself is probably a draw for this card in some world. I don't know if Standard's got a reason for that or will have a reason for that when the rest of the sets show up.
Yeah, World Fine Worm is 8 green, green, green. A 15-15 Trampler makes 3/5/5 worms. So it's only one life less gain, but the key here is what happens when you through the breach this. This gives you 3/5/5s at the end. That gives you a 12/12.
Right.
You know, so I would still rather have World Spine Worm. So I don't see a world where that guy's particularly good.
Probably a moot point. A moot point. But if something gets printed in the future sets of Standard, I guess the point is this, is think about the equivalent in a Standard environment. There may be something that cares about mana cost. You know, there may be something that cares about the cost of a card in your hand that you're discarding.
If it exists, yes, then that will be very good.
But otherwise, I just see this as a very, very casual FNM top end to a dinosaur deck. And I don't know that the dinosaur deck is even going to get much better in this set, but we can hope. Sure.
I totally agree. It's a fun, flavorful top end.
All right. Let's look at Storm the Vault. This one's interesting. Enchantment. Legendary enchantment at that. It is 2 blue-red. Obviously, it's gold. Whenever one or more of your creatures deal combat damage to a player, create a colorless treasure artifact token. We all know what treasures do. At the beginning of your end step, if you control 5 or more artifacts, transform Storm the Vault. And then on the other side, it is Vault of Catlican, which is basically a laboratory.
A reflecting pool stapled to a Talarian Academy.
Yeah, reflecting pool. Oh, add 1 mana of any card to your mana pool. I didn't even notice that. Okay.
Yeah.
Or to have to add blue for each of your artifacts.
Yeah, it's reflecting pool stapled to Talarian Academy. It's insane. Like, so this is an EDH card by about a million miles.
Yeah, it is.
But you play this on turn 5, right? Because you play Brea on turn 4, you play this on turn 5, attack with your copters, get 2 treasures, and flip it. And now you have your desertion up, or if you have 1 more mana, you can cast Spelljack and take your opponent's spell. Or Counterlash and put, you know, if you're counter a creature, put a creature into the battlefield. Like, this card is really good in the right decks.
Yeah, I mean, do you see it being played in Standard?
And no, I don't see this being played in Standard. Yeah, I mean, you might be able to create some sort of Grixis treasure deck that wins with like Revelant Riches and uses this as like card draw engine or something like that.
Yeah.
Where you end up like casting Torrential Gearhulk off of this and like doing the thing. For like,
It's one or more of your creatures. So it's not like you get 1 treasure for each creature. You just get 1 treasure.
This doesn't flip on turn 5 with Brea. I definitely thought this flipped. You got a treasure for each creature you hit with. Okay, this is way less good. Yeah. This is way less good. All right.
It's pretty slow. It's notable that you can flip it when you play it, though. You know, like you can already have the 5 artifacts in play. Or you can have 4 and then attack with a creature and then flip it at the end of your turn.
So here's my one problem with this.
Yeah.
A bunch of the others of these have a May clause.
Yeah, this one does it.
What if I don't want to flip it? What if I just want to, like, make treasure?
Uh-huh.
You know? And so there are not a lot of times where you just want to make treasure. But, like, for the times that I want to make treasure, I just want to leave it as Storm the Vault. And I don't think the option would really affect anything. Like, giving me the option to leave this unflipped, I don't think is a problem. But they didn't. So, all right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting for sure. I don't know what to expect with it in standard. I haven't been playing enough standard to really know where this lies in the format. I mean, but I'm guessing not very functional.
I don't think it's doing anything until energy leaves.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't think anything has much of a shot until energy leaves.
Yeah, probably not. This card I'm looking at might be a thing.
All right.
Enlighten if me. You could live this long. It's Tetzamok, Death Primordial. So it's 4BB for a 6/6 legendary elder dinosaur with death touch. And it has pay black, reveal Tetzamok, put a prey counter on target creature, activate this ability only during your turn. When it enters the battlefield, destroy all creatures with a prey counter on them.
It's pretty cool. There's nothing like this.
So, here's the thing. You can just spend your first couple turns of the game where you don't really have much to do. Just saying all your guys are going to die.
Yeah.
Like, too bad. Eventually this is going to happen and all your guys are going to die.
Yeah, I mean, it's every bit of excess black mana you can use this. You know, you can pour into this.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, so you're going to remove some of their guys. And you're going to remove the ones that are the most threatening, but like the crappy mana dork or the 1/1 or whatever. You're not going to spend a Fatal Push or something like that on it, you know?
Right.
You're just going to be like, all right, eventually this is going to die when I cast this guy. And you just wait. And then eventually you cast the guy, you wipe your opponent's board, and you have 6/6.
Yeah, it feels a little like a Titan in that way, doesn't it? Like you play it and it has so much effect on the front side.
Yeah, and then, like, it's still a 6/6 death touch, so it's just trading with whatever kills it.
Yeah.
You're getting your cards out of this thing. And at 6 mana, I think this is pretty damn good. It's, you know, some people would argue, well, it's not really 6 mana because you're spending all your black mana to put prey counters on stuff along the way. But you don't have to put a prey counter on something if you use your mana.
Well, put it this way. Would you play a card that costs 7 mana, was a 6/6, and destroyed a creature when it came into play? I think it's functional.
I mean, we have a 5/4 menace that does that and gains you some life.
Yeah.
And it's not really seeing any play. And that's a Noxious Cure Hold.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that answers the question. Like, is this that much of an upgrade from that, or is it even an upgrade from that? I don't know.
I mean, it's just dependent on what, you know, how you build your deck and what you're going to be doing with your mana. Like, are you willing to play off curve, or do your opponents give you an opportunity to do so? Like, I think this is really good in, like, energy, against energy decks or mid-range mirrors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you put a prey counter on their Whirler Virtuoso, on their Long Tusk Cub, on their Bristling Hydra, and you're like, all right, kill your stuff, go. And, you know, the only thing that can survive it is, like, a Chandra.
Yeah, sure.
Chandra can't kill it.
It does, so, like, it targets a creature. So I'm thinking, like, against Bristling Hydra.
Oh, it's pretty bad.
Easy. Well, it's not really, because you can activate it as an instant as long as it's on your turn, right?
Yeah.
So you can target the Bristling Hydra for 1 black. They try to give it hexproof. It's not a huge cost for you to just repeatedly play black, and they're emptying all their energy to try to deal with that, you know? Like, that's pretty cool.
Does Bristling Hydra get a counter, though? Because if so, that's still pretty bad.
It does get a counter. It does get a counter, but you're forcing their hand for that, you know?
You're gonna take a million from that thing.
You're what?
Like, you're going to take a billion from that thing.
You know what? Yeah. That was inevitable, though. Like, there isn't a good way to kill Bristling Hydra. This might be a passable way to kill Bristling Hydra.
So, like, here's the thing you can do, is you can use your black mana to force them to use their energy.
Uh-huh.
And you can get them low enough on energy, you can just kill it with a kill spell.
Right. And that's another way to do it,
Spot all their hexproofs. You know, they have a 4/4. You know, if you have, like, a thing that gives it -4/-4, or just kills it... Yeah. Or like a Vraska's Contempt. So, you know, you're on like turn 5 or something, and they play a Bristling Hydra with like 6 energy. You just activate this twice, and then if you just have a thing that says destroy target creature, you just kill it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not wholly horrendous, but like if you don't have a thing to just kill it in response to all their activations, you're going to take a giant pile of damage. Like, so many. Does that thing have trample too?
No.
Bristling Hydra? Oh, thank God.
No, it doesn't. Just a 5/4 hexproof.
Oh, thank God. Okay, so then it's packed. Because you can just put a chump blocker in front of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not as bad.
Yeah, man. So this card is an interesting design, that's for sure.
I like it. It's a great design. It's very flavorful. Yeah. I don't know how good it's going to be. It depends on, like, what other people's decks are doing. Because sure. It doesn't say this Tetzlamok. That's the thing. So
no,
you can
exactly,
just...
yeah.
And just queue up your opponent's dudes, and if they thought seize it or whatever, and you draw another one, you just be like, well, kill your dudes. There you go. Like, and that's great.
Yeah,
or like the essence scatter your first one, you can just play a second one. So, like, that's not wholly unreasonable either. So.
Well, and then even more, Daryl, is like, if this card is a heavily played card in the metagame, like, that creates some really interesting situations because it, like you said, it doesn't say this Tetzimok. You know, you target your opponent's creatures, and your opponent's got a Tetzimok in their hand. That's a dead card until you've cast yours. You know what I mean?
Or they can make your Tetzimok a dead card.
That's right. Or, yeah. It's a weird situation.
Yeah. You can make it to where both of you have a 6/6 Wrath of God, but, like, the thing is...
you never want to play yours first.
Yeah, you never want to play yours first because you may wrath the whole board, but then your opponent's just like, all right, untap, seventh land, counter your Tetzlamok, play a Tetzlamok, go. And then they have a 6/6 and an empty board, and you're just like, oh no, it's horrible.
Right, which is why it's important that you can only do it during your turn, so you can't instant speed target a bunch of their creatures in response to theirs, you know.
Just jam this guy and just make them abysmally sad. Oh yeah. But, like, I do think that it creates a very interesting sub-game if both players are playing this card of, like, well, who blinks first?
Right.
Like if you have two creatures and your opponent has two creatures and both of their guys have a counter on it and they want to, like, put a creature in play and then put a counter on your guy, well, is that creature strong enough that you want to delay your Tetzimok or do you just want to get your 2-for-1 and then, like, make them untap and, like, counter your Tetzimok and play a Tetzimok. Like, so it's, like, the sub-game of this card is really cool if this card gets heavily played. If it doesn't, then the sub-game is just a neat little thing that you can see eventually. But, like, if it's to be played, it's going to be super fun. It's, like, going to be a super fun and, like, very challenging sub-game of who plays their Tetzimoks win.
Right.
Like, what's the game theory optimal way to play it?
Sure. This is a great EDH card. Unfortunately, it's not a good general because it has to be cast from your hand or revealed from your hand, I should say.
That could be your general and you could just prey on things? Oh my god.
But it'll certainly get played in EDH.
Activate my ball coffers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Play this guy.
Yep.
Pretty good.
All right, let's look at the last one. This one is the most exciting to me. The Immortal Sun. It sounds badass already, doesn't it?
It's so bad, but so good.
Oh, it's awesome. Okay, 6 mana, legendary artifact. Players can't activate loyalty abilities of planeswalkers.
Yep.
All right, interesting. If you give your draw step, draw an additional card.
I love that, too.
I love that.
All the way in on this.
Spells you cast cost 1 less to cast.
Huge fan. Like, you don't need to give me any more. I will play this.
But then there's more. Creatures you control get +1/+1. So it does so many different things.
That last line is pretty irrelevant to me. Like, creatures don't really
matter. Most likely, yes. But there are decks that care about that.
Yeah. So, like, the first line is what interests me the most.
Yeah, weird, huh? We haven't seen that before.
It's not a thing that we've ever done before. You can't activate planeswalkers. Like, well, that's very real and worth something. I don't know how many mana it's truly worth, but it actually might be worth a lot of mana. So let's break down the abilities on this card and figure out, is it really fairly costing? So at the beginning of your draw step, draw an extra card. That's worth 2 mana. Howling Mind.
Yeah, but it's only you. I mean, you pay 5 mana for that effect for only you. In any other situation. Like, think, like, the Blue Shrine from Kamigawa.
So, but, like, even if we just say it's, you know, if we take Howling Mind and just say Howling Mind is the baseline.
Okay, fair enough.
Draw an extra card, 2 mana.
Okay.
Spells you cast cost 1 less. That's a magic card. It's Helm of Awakening. It affects everyone.
Again,
same
time.
Let's just say it affects you. That's 2 mana.
But for a point of reference, Stone Calendar, 5 mana for the same effect for just you.
But yeah, let's just say that the cheap versions are...
All right, go on, yeah.
creatures you control get +1/+1. That's a 3-mana effect. Glorious Anthem, Spear of Heliod, Gaia's Anthem. That's 3 mana. That's 7 mana worth of effects. And that's like 5 blue, white, white, or 5 green, green. Not just 6. So, like, you're already getting your money's worth from this card if you pay 6 colorless mana.
Yeah,
what the hell is the loyalty abilities of Planeswalkers not being able to be activated worth?
Well, like, it's priceless. It's the only option. It's the only place to get it.
It's a throw-in, but it's essentially free. Like, but, like, what is that really worth on a mana cost? Like, I would almost say it's worth 4 mana. Like, that's really strong.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe 3 or 4. That's like the most relevant part of this card to me, I think.
I agree 100%. Because by the time you get to 6 mana, you're not trying to catch cheaper spells, really. Your creatures might be relevant, but like the top 2 abilities are the important ones. I wish this cost 5.
You're telling me that you get so much value for an honor costed rate and you want it to be cheaper.
I do. I'm a greedy bastard and I want this to cost more. It's not going to play in my EDH.
Yeah.
And use it and it costs 5. That's all I want.
You know, the only thing it's missing, Daryl, is mana. When you tap a land for mana, it produces an additional color of that type or something like that. Like doubles your mana. You know, it seems like that belongs in here at some point for maybe like 8 or 9 mana.
It's the immortal sun. It shines over all things. It can make anything be anything.
Yeah.
I would take Chromatic Lantern. You know, if we just want to put 1 billion abilities on this, give me Chromatic Lantern, you know?
Yeah, that would be cool.
This is certainly a really good card in EDH.
Absolutely. But, yeah, I mean, you see this seeing play in Constructed at all?
I don't know. So, like, I mean, what?
75 card Constructed.
So, here's my problem with that. My problem with that is you have to play this card in a format that has a shit ton of Planeswalkers.
Right. Yeah, and I don't think that's modern, and I don't think it's Legacy.
I don't think it's standard. Legacy does have a lot of Planeswalkers, but there's just so much other busted stuff happening that, like, it's not particularly good. So there's a deck in Modern that plays – or Legacy that plays Staff of Nin.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, it's all the Metalworker decks.
Yeah.
So do you know what Metalworker is?
Yeah.
Okay, for those of you who don't, it's a 3-mana 1/3 that taps to add 2 mana to your mana pool for every artifact you reveal from your hand. Just 2 colorless mana. So, like, that deck plays Staff of Nin. And, like, pinging things is relevant against, like, Death and Taxes. But, like, I think that, like, making your bazillion cost spells a little cheaper, plus getting your free card draw, and then, oh, by the way, you can't lose to Jace the Mind Sculptor? That's a big deal. Because, like, the way that the Metalworker deck loses is that, like, they kill your Metalworker, and then you don't draw a bunch of Cloud Posts or whatever your big mana engine is, or, like, 2 mana lands.
Uh-huh.
And they play a Jace, and they just Fate Seal you the whole game. So, like, putting this – if you can put this card into play, like, you can play one giant thing, and you put this card into play, then your opponent can't beat you with Jace.
Yeah.
And Liliana, which is a big deal.
Yeah, that's true.
So, like, I think this will replace Staff of Nin in those decks, but I think that's really the only place it's going to see much play.
Okay. I'm wondering, like, if Standard becomes the land of Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, or, like, similar at some point, like, if it's worth playing a card like this in the sideboard of, like, a big control deck.
People are trying to drown the meta with Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, and Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, and, like, Huatli becomes a big deal, and, like, Liliana Death's Majesty, and people are throwing Planeswalkers everywhere. I would be jamming this card mainboard. I'd be like, all right, you don't have Planeswalkers, go.
Yeah, I think it's got a lot of other things to offer for it, whereas, you know, the corner case of maybe I'm playing against the Planeswalker deck this time, maybe I'm not, it makes it worthwhile to play main deck in that kind of environment. I would agree with that.
So, and I think that, like, the ramp decks want to play this card. If a ramp deck exists, it wants this card. Because it's a ramp spell, so, like, it starts out as, like, you're a rampant growth. But, like, every spell you cast basically casts a free rampant growth. You don't get to put a land into play, but you got an extra mana to pay for your spell, which is basically what a rampant growth does over the course of time. It gives you a mana to pay for spells.
Yeah.
So every time you play this, you basically got a rampant growth out of it. like every spell you cast. Plus, the ramp decks want to draw cards. So if a ramp deck exists, it's going to get to 5, 6, 7. You know, it's going to go like 3-drop, go get a, there's like a 3-drop ramp spell that gets a land, and then like Hour of Promise, and then like Immortal Sun, go. And then like you draw a card, you play an 8-drop or a 9-drop or whatever. Like if there's a deck that exists that is going to do something like that, this is a, I think, a very good haymaker in the deck to go alongside Carnage Tyrant.
Yeah, sure, man. That I could see that. I hope it does. That's really fun.
I think the card is just super cool, and I'm probably going to get a copy for one of my EDHs. I don't even know which one I would put it in.
Yeah, people are complaining about lazy design when it comes to EDH in the comments of the Mythic spoiler page on this one.
I mean,
I can see it. You know, I get it.
So
it's it's a card that can fit into any deck, and there are few reasons not to include it.
Like, here's the concept you have to go for here.
Yeah.
And you have to look at it from a lore perspective to understand, like, this. So the people who are like, EDH, Ermagerd, this is horrible. Like, there's some lore here that you have to look at, and you have to buy into the flavor of, like, the sun is everyone's. The sun doesn't belong to green or white or, you know, whatever. Yeah. The sun is everyone's. And the Immortal Sun is so amazing that people that even rise above being contained on places are can't do anything against it. So that's how we get the Planeswalkers thing, and then just like all this other stuff. The sun provides you life, and so we can.
You okay over there?
My girlfriend's walking. but you can get to all this other stuff through the sun being truly immortal.
Yeah.
You know, like, so people who are complaining about the poor design just aren't buying into the flavor of the card.
Yeah, so. Of course, I get it. Let's move on here. We got Unstable coming out. We don't need to talk too much about the spoilers for Unstable, but there are the entire set is spoiled at this point, and it looks like a hell of a lot of fun. There's a lot of interactive stuff happening in here that involves players outside of the game, or you know, at a game next to you that you can see from your seat.
So there's just cards in this set that I just want to play in, like, regular formats.
Yeah. Crowstorm? I love Crowstorm.
Not Crowstorm. I just want to play X.
Yeah, X is really cool. Really hard to understand, but really cool. You want to read that one?
Yeah, let me find the multicolored part of the spoiler real quick. I think it's probably on the last page.
Okay.
Or as I like to yell, he gonna give it to you. X gonna give it to you. So here we go. I found the multicolored. So X, blue-black. For a 2/2 legendary creature, human spy. As long as X is in X's owner's opponent's hand, X's owner may cast X and activate X's abilities. That opponent can't cast X and plays with his or her hand revealed. Blue-black tap, put X into target opponent's hand. 3, blue-black, you may play a card in the same hand as X without paying its mana cost. So the letter X was said a lot there. I'm going to just walk through how it would work in a real game. So you have this card. You put it into play. You pay blue-black and you tap it. You put it into somebody's hand. As long as it's in that person's hand, they cannot cast it. They reveal their hand. You can pay 3 blue-black to cast any card from that player's hand without paying its mana cost at instant speed. Yeah. You can also just cast X from your opponent's hand whenever it would be appropriate to cast X, unless you just want to pay 3 blue black and put X into play at instant speed, so that you could then untap with it, put it into another player's hand, and repeat the process.
That's pretty awesome.
I think it's pretty damn sweet.
Yeah.
The only problem is if your opponent can, like, figure out a way to discard it, then they discard it. And no, X is no longer going to give it to you. But I'm going to use that pawn as much as I can. But it's just a card I want to make my commander in an EDH game.
Right.
And just put it into somebody's hand and be like, all right, let's go.
I hope you can find a group that allows you to play these cards in Commander, because there's just so much that they allow, so many fun situations.
Good ones, to be fair.
Yeah, there's some really powerful creatures in Commander. The clock guy that counts down from five and then destroys a player is awesome and hilariously like flavor-tastic, but not a great creature.
Pretty vulnerable. This guy is not the kind of guy you would want to have as a general.
But definitely a fun build around. I mean, yes, it's certainly not a competitive general, but I would love to build a deck around playing five mana cards and cards with fours in them. And
you could really easily do that, right? So, you could,
yeah.
Like, let's just, in red black, let's just take on the experiment here and try and find five cards that we can just cast. Because it's literally anywhere on the card. So, like, in the mana cost, you have, like, Gauntlet of Power. You can just play it. It's going to double your mana. You count the doom down.
Right.
You know, mana cards, Grasp of Darkness. You could play Dismember. You can play any black creature with four power. You know, like, Liliana of the Veil on three.
There are plenty of possibilities.
Or on two. Like, there's a lot of stuff. Get your way through this. Can you make somebody lose three life? Because that'll count you down to three. Like, there's a lot of cards that you would be surprised, I think, how easy it is to just kill players with Baron Von Count.
Yeah, he's a lot of fun, that's for sure. But he's certainly one of those cards that you play and he immediately gets a target put on his back, unless someone agrees with you that this particular player must die and they want to help you ensure that happens.
So that part makes it the most fun in the world. You play Baron Von Count and you count down to one and you play a one mana spell or something dumb like that.
Uh-huh.
And or you play like a Doom Blade with a one in the mana cost. And then you kill another player instead of the one you said you would kill. And you start the countdown over. And you just politics be damned, just start killing random people.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's what I just imagined doing with this thing. Is like saying that I'll kill one person and then politics be damned, just murder someone else.
Yeah, exactly. My favorite card in the set, I got to talk about this one before I move on here, Masterful Ninja. It's got the best damn art in the entire set. It's two and a black for a 1/1 troll ninja, and it's basically the cheaty face of this set. It's got haste. It says, reveal Masterful Ninja from your hand, and Masterful Ninja is on the battlefield and in your hand until end of turn. So basically, it can be snuck onto the battlefield and attack. And then it can pump for one and a black. It gets +1/+1 until end of turn. The picture is like an empty room. Because the ninja's so damn masterful that you can't even see him. And he's in the room. Yeah. He just might be hiding behind the curtain on the left side of the image, but I can't tell from this picture. But the fact that he's just not in the picture, or not visible in the picture, makes it so hilariously perfect.
The great part is, like, I have to ask the question, if he's on the battlefield and in your hand and he dies, do you discard him?
Yeah, I assume so. Yeah, I mean, he goes in the graveyard then, because he's on the battlefield.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
So there's definitely another sweet card that I would want to play as there's one as a general and one just in a deck.
Uh-huh.
The card in a deck is just Over My Dead Bodies.
Yeah, that's hilarious too.
Creature cards can attack as if they're in play. And the other one that also just gives you all the graveyards.
Yeah, it literally says say? You have all the graveyards. And what's the text on that one?
Hold on, I have to go back to the first page because it's a blue card. I can't remember what it's called though.
I found it. Graveyard Busybody. Graveyards are also your graveyards.
Yeah, Graveyard Busybody. Number of cards with flavor text in all your graveyards. But yeah, all graveyards are also your graveyards. So that is a very, very crazy ability because then you get to do stuff like cast Exhum and take cards out of your opponent's graveyards because you pick first with Exhum. Uh-huh. So if someone has something sweet, you take it out of their graveyard and put it into play, and they don't get it. But, like, that's the kind of stuff I want to do. And then the other card, as general, is just Spike. Just, like, I just play like Exotic Orchard and City of Brass and Chromatic Lantern, and then just spike for stuff like Balance and just pass Balance. And just be like, all right, guys, we're going to Balance Town. Or
yeah, people are really wanting to buy the shirt that Spike's wearing, the Nope shirt with the O being the blue mana symbol.
That's because blue is the best color.
Which Nope. I totally don't blame him. It's awesome. Yeah, man. Yeah. A lot of cool stuff going on. I love the fact that there are so many like typical rules of the game that are just broken by this set. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, the Grand Count. Also, Urza's Headmaster, just beautiful. Go to the website.
Yeah.
Like, what happens if you don't have a smartphone? Do you have to call a judge every time you activate your planeswalker?
Yeah, you probably do. Or you have to bring a laptop.
Oh my god, that's glorious.
Yeah, so definitely looking forward to it. The Grand Calcutron reminds me of the game Robo Rally. Have you ever played Robo Rally? It's a Richard Garfield game, so I'm sure this is an homage to Robo Rally. But the game is hilarious. You're like a bunch of robots on this big grid with all these obstacles and things, and basically you're battle bots. You're trying to race across the map to collect the checkpoints and get to the end. But it's not as easy as it seems because you put your five movement cards down in registers and you flip them up one at a time and you make your moves simultaneously with other players and in an order of priority based on like where this little satellite is on the map.
So, I have to read the Grand Calcutron before you continue.
The Grand Calcutron basically does that. It puts your cards in your hand into an order, and they basically are going to have to be cast in that order. So, you want to read out loud, Daryl?
Yeah, I'll read it out loud. When the Grand Calcutron enters the battlefield, each player's hand becomes a program, an ordered row of revealed cards. Players can only play the first card in their program. If a card would be put into a player's hand from anywhere, that player reveals it and places it anywhere within his or her program instead. At the beginning of each player's end step, if that player's program has fewer than five cards, he or she draws cards equal to the difference.
Which is like straight out of Robo Rally. You have five cards that you put in the program, and the hilarity of it is, while it was a good idea at the time, when they actually resolve themselves in the order that they resolve themselves, you often end up driving yourself into a buzzsaw or off the map into your death. Yes. And so this can happen in Grand Calcutron.
So here's the thing. Us as Magic players, or at least for me, I do this. I am very regimented with the way the cards in my hand are set. I put all the lands on the left, all the spells right. I order them by converted mana cost. I put the things that match together. So if like I have two spreading seeds, I put them both together right after my Serum Vision. This totally blows the lid off of like how normal people play with their cards in hand. And like also shuffling your hand like most people do. If someone like plays the Grand Calcutron, you maintain priority to rearrange your hand. So that when the Grand Calcutron enters play, you can play the cards in your hand. And if people don't think of that, they're going to get completely blown out. Like, when they say, okay, it resolves,
then they're
trying to move their hand around. It's like, nope, you put your hand face up, and you got, like, five drops at the left side. You're just like, damn it. You just want to flip the table over? So you have to, like, maintain priority while they're casting the Grand Calcutron to rearrange your hand to like make sure you can play all your cards, which is freaking hilarious to me.
That is hilarious. You better not be flipping through your cards, being the obnoxious player that's making the flipping card noise while you're trying to concentrate, and just totally screw yourself on the Grand Calcutron. I like Hotfix, too. Have you seen that one? You have six mana. Yeah. Basically, you have 10 seconds to stack your deck.
Yeah, you have 10 seconds to stack your deck.
That's hilarious. All right, we better move on. There's a lot in this set that we could just go on about, but let's save it until after we get a chance to play it. I'm definitely going to be doing so.
One more thing before we move on. I'm going to warn people, the card better than one. A person outside the game becomes your teammate. You give them some hands, some libraries, some battlefield, and they own all of that, whatever you give them. Don't pick the judge.
Why is that?
Because if the judge decides they just want to concede, you lose.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if the player you picked to have a teammate just says, I concede, you lose the game. So, don't do that.
Yep. You got to trust the person you're picking, huh?
Yeah. You better have some friends at the pre-release that'll play games with you.
Two mana, don't pick your opponent's ride.
Yeah, don't pick your opponent's ride.
All right, cool. Good advice, Daryl. Thank you. Let's talk about Search for Azcanta in Modern. Karnak Life is supported by The Discard. Visit thediscard.com for a variety of Magic content, including news, set reviews, limited, and constructed strategy. Interested in playing Constructed without the painful cost of digital objects and steep loss in value at rotation? Our friends at ManaTraders.com offer a subscription rental service allowing the rental of up to 1,250 tickets worth of cards in Standard, Modern, Legacy, Commander, Pauper, or Vintage. Give them a shot at ManaTraders.com and tell them we sent you by entering this month's promo code CKL at checkout for 7% off your subscription for the first 5 months.
The card is the best card.
I love it, man.
Like, so I picked up a Search for Azcanta to play Modo CEDH, like to play, you know, 1v1 EDH on Modo. I put it in my three color control deck, and then it's like, okay, this card's okay, whatever. And one of my friends was like, I picked up Francisco's blue white wish deck. I put a Search for Azcanta. I was like, why don't we play a Search for Azcanta? I think the card's okay.
Yeah.
So I put it in the deck, and I drew it, and I played it, and I was just like, how does anyone ever beat this card? Like, if you're not playing Spreading Fees or, like, Ghost Quarter, how do you ever beat that card?
You like, don't. You can't beat it when it's resolved, when it's flipped.
Literally impossible to beat that card. If you're not, like, playing Burn or something, like, it just, like, when you play it and you, like, untap with it, you're like, all right, I don't like this card, throw it away, all right, sweet. Like, Scry 1 is, like, completely reasonable for a 2-mana enchantment. On your upkeep, Scry 1. Thassa did that for 3-mana, and people were like, oh, that's the best part of Thassa. The rest of it is fine, but that's the best part. Scry 1 on a 2-mana enchantment, pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And then just, like, turning it over and having this insane card advantage engine is ridiculous. Like, I played about 30 games with the blue-white Glittering Wish deck with a Sphinx's Revelation and a Search for Azcanta. And I was like, you know, I want to know which one of these I really want, because I'm just the biggest fan of Sphinx's Revelation. I like to draw all the cards and gain all the life. And I played 30 games, and I drew them roughly at the same 50-50 rate, because I had one of each, so, like, you just draw your random one of. And I felt so much further ahead in the games where I drew Search for Azcanta than the games where I drew Sphinx's Revelation. And, like, I played two games in a match where, like, I resolved the Sphinx's Revelation for 4 and lost the game. And then I resolved Search for Azcanta on turn 2 and, like, ended the game with 3 Planeswalkers in play and, like, 6 cards in my hand. And I was just like, okay, like, this card is clearly just much better than Sphinx's Revelation. And so I've been testing this, like, basically blue-white dead to Spell Snare deck. It has, like, 18 2-drops in it or something stupid like that. It has a ridiculously large amount of 2-drops. And instead of playing any Sphinx's Revelations, it's been, like, 4 Spreading Seas, 4 Singer Visions, 2 Search for Azcanta. And, like, I ran out of cards, like, once or twice, but, like, never felt like I was completely out of the game when I've drawn a Search for Azcanta. Just like, all right, we're going to flip it. We're going to try and play this really prolonged game and see if our opponent can figure out something to do. Like, I think I'm 7-0 against Grixis Death Shadow, because you can just curve, like, Azcanta into Gideon, and, like, your Grixis Death Shadow opponent can never beat that.
You're talking 3-mana Gideon?
3-mana Gideon. You just go, like, Search for Azcanta into Gideon of the Trials, yeah, and you plus on their Shadow, and then they play another one, and you play Rune Halo, and they're just like, well, I can kill your Gideon.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
the best I've got, other than that, my deck doesn't do anything now.
Yeah, it is incredible. It's really, really, like, good. And the flipped version provides you everything you want in a control deck. You know, it's like, we look at the other transform cards, and we're looking at this blue-red one from the new set, and we're kind of thinking, like, yeah, you flip it, you don't, it's not a May, it has to flip, right? And it provides you with a ridiculous amount of mana, but it doesn't provide you with anything to do with that mana, you know? And so, like, it needs to be paired with something that can cash in on all that value, whereas Azcanta flipped provides you mana because it's a land, And it provides you this dig, this really, really powerful dig, where you can realistically have no cards in your hand, and you can almost count on drawing into a removal spell or an answer spell or a counter spell when you're needing to find one.
Like, here's the thing. You said that, you know, the search the vault provides you mana. So, like, if you go from no artifacts to search the vault with just search the vault, you gain 10 mana and have nothing to do with it.
Right, yeah. You're not drawing anything else off the top of your deck.
So with Search Staz Kanta, you gain a mana sometimes. So, like, sometimes if you play specifically a deck with, like, Thought Scours to, like, flip it as quick as you can, you can flip it on turn 3 if you have a bunch of fetch lands. And then you can just cast Wrath of Bal on turn 4. Or Jace, Architect of Thought. Or Gideon, Ally of Zendikar. Or 4 mana black or blue Planeswalker, you know, or like some very powerful card ahead of curve. And then once you've, you know, ran out of gas, you can just start drawing more cards. And it's so insanely powerful that, like, I feel like I've played, like, the blue-white control mirror, and I've put my opponents in position where I've, like, countered their path to exiles with spells, and just activated my colonnades into ghost quarters and not cared, just so I could flip as Kanta and win the game. Like, I literally played a game where my opponent played 4 Field of Ruins, and I activated my colonnade, countered his path to exiles, and ran them into Field of Ruins. And then eventually, on, like, turn 10, I just played a search for as Kanta, flipped it, activated it, got a Crucible of Worlds, casted it, and put a colonnade back to play. And my opponent was just like, I can't win the game! Like, can't win the game! Like... So the card is just amazing. And I think that if you are playing any control deck in Modern, Jeskai, Grixis, Esper, Blue-White, Blue-Red is the only one I wouldn't play in it. Because most of the time your Blue-Red control decks are Blood Moon decks.
Right, right.
So, like, flipping your Azkanta into a mountain is pretty bad. But then you can just not flip it.
That's and pretty bad, but it's still good in the deck. It's still playable, I think.
Like, that's the thing. If Blood Moon is bad in the matchup, you can just mill your Blood Moons and flip it and go nuts.
Yeah.
In the matchup, you can just leave it face up, scry one every turn, and move on with your day.
Yeah, so, like, I'm a believer. I mentioned the Grixis control deck that I was playing it in maybe our last cast or two casts ago I still love it in there, and I think it's even better with the rise of Search for Azkanta in a Grixis-style deck where you've got, like, Fulminator Mage package. I think the value of destroying lands is really, really good right now. There's a lot of value in that. We're dealing with, like, humans decks who play these mana bases that are really small but have a lot of these really valuable gold lands.
Yeah, 5-color lands. Yeah.
And other similar aggro decks that play really small amounts of lands but are required to, you know, have access to many colors, and you can really take advantage of that. In addition to the opposing search for Azkantas, the Tron lands, the man lands, there's a lot of value in killing lands.
Yeah, like my only problem with playing Fulminator Mage, like you said, is that you can't hit it with Azkanta. So I would rather play Spreading Seeds.
Well, you hit the Kolaghan's Command with Search for Azkanta, and then you get it back. But it's a little slow, but...
Yeah, that's why, like, with your Fulminator Mage plan, and this is just something you might want to try, I don't know if the ability to get it with Kolaghan's Command and do it really slowly is much better. Try Spreading Seeds, because you can Azkanta into it, and it's a cantrip, and that kind of just moves you through your deck much better. I don't know if you have, you know, card volume issues where you don't see enough cards. But if you do, try Spreading Seeds over Fulminator Mage, so in those game twos you can sort of cycle your way through your deck.
Yeah, that's fair. That's possible. I think that I've heard that argument a lot, is like, you can't find this or this off of Search for Azkanta. But it's like, the deck only runs 3 creatures. You know, if I'm going to be playing Fulminator Mages, I'm usually boarding out other creatures to put Fulminator Mages in. I'm never too disappointed to hit other removal spells or other control spells, like a Cryptic Command off of that. You know,
absolutely.
Like, it's fine.
Yeah, and I look at it the same way. I was like, man, I should play, like, a Batterskull or something. Because I was considering, like, playing another win condition. I'm like, I could play a Torrential Gearhulk, but I can't hit that with Azkanta. So I should play a Batterskull.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Just
play a Torrential Gearhulk. Like, this card's really good. But no, like, you started out, like, I thought Azkanta was okay for, like, EDH. And it was, like, fine. And you were just like, nope, this card's great. Just play it. And I'm willing to totally admit, you've got a believer in me now. It's insane. And I literally will not be playing a blue modern deck that is like a control deck or a mid-range deck without it. from now on.
Cool.
Straight up.
The other one that I was actually higher on Treasure Map, I think, from the get go. And I'm not willing to admit defeat on that one yet. I think there's still a time for Treasure Map. The problem is it has such a similar function to Escanta. It's got a scry ability on the front side, and then it's got a card draw ability on the back side. It's like it does the same thing but worse.
Yeah, you have to invest mana, and like so the problem is with Escanta. Once you use Escanta 3 times, you've seen more cards because you've seen 12 versus 3.
Yeah.
And then the fourth time, you can still activate as Kanta. Whereas a Treasure Map, once you've eaten your treasures, that's it. Like, backside didn't do anything. So.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, like, Treasure Map is a search for Escanta you can play in non-blue decks. You know, and, like, there's got to be a place for that in Standard at some point. But I can't. I mean, I can see that being a case in, like, a big green deck, too. Like.
If that's the case, there's a card I would rather play over that, and that's Conqueror's Galleon.
Conqueror's Galleon.
Yeah. It's the one that flips into 2-mana loot, 4-mana draw card, 6-mana Eternal Witness.
Uh-huh.
It's like crew 4 for a 2/10. After you attack with it, flip it.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I would rather play that over Treasure Map, because I would rather have the option to just, like, play the same busted card from my graveyard over and over and over. Like, just activate this end turn, pick it up, play it, go. Oh, you killed it again. I have the mana to activate this thing, pick it up, play it again. And, like, if not, you can just draw a card every turn.
Eh, I don't know. It's good. It's a good card, but it requires a creature with power 4. And you got to pay 4 for it. I know it's got more upside on the flip side of it, but...
Totally, like... If I had to choose between one or the other, and you're talking about, you're like, well, what if I want a big green deck or something like that? Or a green deck, I'd rather play Conqueror's Galleon.
Sure.
So.
All right.
Yeah. Flip cards. Enough flip card jargon. We said flip cards. We only really wanted to talk about those for Escanta. What else do we got?
All right. We got one more thing, and I just want to cover this briefly before we close out, because we're at about an hour already. But,
All right.
The last thing on the agenda today is to talk about the GPs in the upcoming year, which now we know, we've known this for a while, but now Channel Fireball is taking over all of the Magic GPs.
I was a fan of this.
You were? Okay. There are some changes that are kind of rolling out now that haven't been very clear. But I think that Reddit is kind of breaking the news on this one. No longer... Do you get playmats for the GP entry fee? And this seems insignificant to some, but that's a big deal for GPs. I think that's a way to recoup some of the costs on GPs. You go to the event, you pay $70 a play. You can sell the playmats for $25 or so online.
And it's just annoying. Like,
it is. It's a pain in the ass. And with one company having a monopoly on all GPs, they can do that with no explanation.
So here's the thing. If you look at the second registration add-ons piece...
Yeah.
They hit it on the head why I want the playmat. Grand Prix Memphis playmat, $14.99. Get the exclusive Grand Prix Memphis playmat as a souvenir of the event.
Uh-huh.
I want to have these souvenirs so that when I play with my GP Memphis playmat, you know, if I jump on a plane and chill out with you and chill out with, you know, some other people that I know, I want to be able to look at that and be like, yeah, I hung out with all my friends at this tournament and Corey ran deep and I scrubbed out and played Commander while I was there hanging out with him, hoping he would do well, or, you know, whatever the story is, or like we ate way too many like egg rolls at the Chinese place and ended up vomiting all night on Sunday night, or some dumb story. Or we drank
a soy sauce stain on my playmat.
Or just like the stories that come from the events that you have with the people.
Right.
Like, sure, you'll remember the stories, but having that object to conjure those memories back is also just a really neat memento.
So
I really like that about the playmats, and it's frustrating to me that I have to pay more to get that.
Right. And here's the deal. Like, so for a main event registration, for a constructed event, it looks like it's about $70. You get entry into the GP. You get the foil promo Mutavault that they're giving out. You get a Channel Fireball deck box, whoop-de-doo, and a Channel Fireball life pad and pen. End of story. Okay, you can pay $14.99 more for the playmat. But also for the limited events, it's about $85 for the main event registration, and then you have to pay an additional $15 for the playmat, which you're looking at $100 freaking dollars. This to me just seems like a huge cash grab, and it just sucks. It really sucks. It already feels that way when you go to a GP and you're shelling out $75 to play an event.
Yeah.
But now it's like they're really taking the thing that makes GPs different from Star City Games events and other opens and other big events away, and that's the playmats.
So here's the thing. Now Star City Games events feel better than
they do give out the
feel better than GPs, unless you're trying to get on the Pro Tour. Because I get a playmat to commemorate the event. And you know, they made a mistake by going away from their creature collection and just every event of the season you just get, you know, playmat X of a card. You know,
I'm cool with that. I don't like the creature collection, but
you can do things like bring a Sharpie with you and write down the event name and stuff like that. If you're keeping them personally as mementos, you're not trying to sell them. You write the event name and get all your friends to sign it because that's who you went there with and that's what it's about for you. But you get this playmat that you can do something like that with. The event costs less. I haven't been to a Channel Fireball event, but I can say that Star City's events are run at the top shelf of organization. They do an amazing job. Mm-hmm. And even when I played in an Invitational where the first round was delayed for 45 minutes, they hotfixed charging stations for people's phones, and they're like, hey, everyone just be back at this time. We're not going to try and keep giving you events because the power went out or something like that. You know? For a short amount of time. It was nothing they had control of. They're just like, you know, every hour we'll tweet out, you know, what's the status of what's going on, and you can feel free to we'll tweet out, come back at 11:30, and, you know, we'll give you a half hour to come back after that.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's a big deal.
Yeah, like you said, GPs already feel like a cash grab. It's rough on the players. It costs a hell of a lot to play. You have to put up for lodging. And the events that they do, that they fire on demand, it's like, it feels even worse sometimes. You know, the single elimination events, it costs like $30 to play in. You scrub out in the first game and it's like, God, my pocketbook took another hit. So now it's just one more thing you have to pay for. I don't want to feel like an entitled Magic player. I don't want to sound like an entitled Magic player. But why take something away that was obviously successful and obviously a draw for the event? And what are we really paying for if we're paying $70 for the event? You know, it's like certainly not going to the judges.
Yeah, no, it's not.
I just wanted to point that out. Be aware. I hope we're all pissed about this because we ought to be. You know, we got to make sure that we demand the highest quality from Channel Fireball. Now that they've been handed all of the GPs, they've got to provide a quality experience to maintain that. I hope that's something that we can come to expect from them, rather than just the feared comfort of being the monopoly on that and just being able to do whatever the hell they want with it.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's all I got for today. Stay tuned. I'm going to be posting some more stuff on the website. We took some time off. I know it's been running kind of slow in the last week, but that's because of the holidays. It got busy last week. We got some family and some traveling to do. We'll resume our typical output of content. And there's plenty to talk about with all the stuff that we covered in this cast. And I look forward to playing some Unstable and reporting back on that as well.
Nice.
So thank you for listening, and we will talk to you later. Cardnock Life is proud to be a part of mtgcast.com. We can be reached at cardnocklifepodcast.com or on Twitter at card_knock_life. We're always looking for more help in generating content for the website, and if you'd be interested in doing so, please email at cardnocklifepodcast@gmail.com.